sign up today? Excellent. Thank you so much.
We're going to call to order the meeting of the Senate Committee on Education. Today's March 12th. We have a little bit of business to take care of at the very beginning. We have, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 519 and with the dash one amendments. Do you want to give us a short explanation of the bill and the fact that we have gotten an agreement from community colleges and all the others who were a little concerned before with the dash one? So.
Certainly. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 519 directs community college districts to use a uniform budget and accounting system. This bill has no subsequent referral by prior reference. I believe we'll be adding one today. It does have a fiscal statement issued for the dash one amendments, and there's no revenue impact for the dash one amendments.
Okay. So, Senator, is there any discussion in the committee with regard to the bill? Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the dash one amendments as presented to Senate Bill 519.
Senator Canope moves to adopt the dash one amendments as presented. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, it is amended. Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 519 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
So Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 519 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Any discussion?
Yeah, but having nothing to do with the bill.
Oh, okay. That's what I figured. Is there any opposition to this? Is there any opposition? No opposition down there either. Okay. With that, so moved, and the bill will move to Ways and Means. And thank you for that. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 519. We're going to open a work session for Senate Bill 421, and this is for the actual purpose of moving it to a different committee where all of the bills that are currently residing with regard to school nursing and so on. And this is at the request of the sponsor of this bill, actually, Senator Cruz. Do you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the school nurses and school-based health centers, we kind of want to get a better picture of the whole universe there, number one. But number two, we're thinking that because most of the kids that present in those settings are either CHIP or Medicaid eligible, it would make more sense that it be Medicaid funding rather than formula funding. So that's the universe of what we're trying to do. And I'm assuming this was sent to this committee because it says Department of Ed, but it's going to be a collaboration between Department of Ed and Oregon Health Authority. So it'd be nice to have all the bills in one place.
So with that, Senator Canope.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 421 without recommendation to the Senate Committee on Health Care.
So Senator Canope moves Senate Bill 421 without recommendation to the Senate Committee on Health Care. Is there any discussion? You look like you might want to discuss.
No, I'm just listening.
Okay.
I'm the bad student today. I'm sorry.
Being no discussion, is there any opposition to doing this, making this move? Seeing none, so moved. And we will send off this wonderful bill from Senator Cruz to its new home at the Health Care Committee. With that, we're going to close our work session on Senate Bill 421. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 321. And this is a continuation from last week because we ran out of time, and we have a list of people who wanted to talk before. And if with that, we will have a short explanation of the dash one amendments. Do you want to do that, or do you want to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll have Senator Haas give an explanation.
I just wanted to say we did offer an amendment in talking to some of my colleagues and other legislators in the spirit of collaboration and compromise so that the bill with the dash one amendments would lower the mandatory age from 7 to 6 and not 5. So that's what the dash ones do. I also, if I could very briefly address inaccuracies that were brought up in the last hearing. One of them was that the Europeans don't do this, that we should take a clue from them. And That's not true. Most European countries reflect kind of the United States in that most of them have 5 and 6 year old mandatory ages, and some have 7. In fact, according to the European Commission on Education, 66% of European nations start school at 6, 40% start at age 5 and under, and only 16% start at 7. So that's Europe, and I only mention that because it was addressed and brought up earlier. And also to a gentleman who said there is no research that shows that this is, that lowering the minimum age or starting an earlier ends up or has an outcome of a successful academic career, that's inaccurate too. There is plenty of research, most notably the High School Perry preschool study through age 40 that is now 10 years old, that shows just the opposite, that indeed starting earlier and more time in school does result in a more successful academic career, particularly the grade school years. And we have links and these studies in our offices, and we'll provide them to the committee, and the European Commission information is already with the committee. So I just wanted to address those things, and I'm not bringing those up on my own. Those are from the previous meeting. So
thank you very much. With that, we have our list from last time. Heather Church, is it Millie Burton?
Funk.
Thank you. I couldn't tell if it was an I or a U, so thank you. And Tammy, who wants to pronounce that last name again?
Castronovo.
It's perfect. It's just like it's supposed to be, Castronovo. Thank you. Yeah, it was very nice. And we'll use our timer like we did last time. So once you get started, you have about 2 minutes. So, and if you have anything in written testimony, others you want to have in addition, we'll accept it all before we make a decision on this bill. As you know, it's only posted for a public hearing, so we'll not be taking a vote today. We just want to get all the information before we make that decision. So with that,
thank you. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Heather Church, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Christian Education Association Network, OCEAN Network. I'm from Salem, and I was asked by the legislative coordinator for OCEAN Network, Roger Williams, to read his testimony as he was unable to attend today. This is Mr. Williams' testimony. I would like to address the idea that this bill will solve the problem where some kindergarten and first grade students are chronically absent, that is, they skip school. There is already statutory language addressing this problem. ORS 339.0102 and ORS 339.0202. This existing law specifies that, quote, all children 5 or 6 years of age who have been enrolled in a public school are required to attend regularly the public school while enrolled in the public school. So the compulsory attendance requirements for regular attendance are already in place for enrolled kindergarten and first grade students. Senate Bill 321 will not improve the legal remedies available to schools for dealing with chronic absenteeism, because enrolled students are already covered by the compulsory attendance law. The existing law gives the twin benefits of ensuring the regular attendance of students who are enrolled in school, and two, giving parents the flexibility to wait to enroll their children until those children are ready for the rigors of institutional schooling. That is the best of both worlds. Why wreck it? And that's the end of Mr. Williams' testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify. I'm Millie Burton Funk. I'm not representing anyone but my family. I do have two degrees in home economics, one from Oregon State University, and we deal with families and individuals within that family and their impact on each other and on society. I taught at OSU, and I also taught my own children, homeschooled them for 17 years. I wanted to tell you that I have a written testimony that is pretty specific about some quotes and statistics, but I wanted to tell you about two things that I know personally. One is that while I was a graduate student at OSU, we had another colleague of mine was working on super children. Parents who are very interested in involving their children early in all kinds of activities and wanting them to get ahead. It usually doesn't work. I taught piano in addition to all of the other things that I've taught, and a lot of parents want their students to teach me to teach piano at ages 4 or 5 because they want to get a head start. But by that time that child is 12, they're at the same spot as the child who started at 8 in piano. And this is true all across the board, not just in teaching piano. I want to tell you about a story about my neighbor. I reached the end of our driveway as he was walking home from school. Max was in second grade, and he was very excited, on fire, because he had learned something in math, and especially in subtraction that day. So I said, well, Max, if you have 2 chickens and you take one away, how many do you have? And he had a downcast face, and he said, oh, I guess that's not what I learned today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today on SB 321. My name is Danny Castronovo. I'm from Salem, Oregon. And I really feel strongly that it should be up to the parent whether or not their child is developmentally able or ready to begin formal education at age 5 or 6. I'm especially grateful that I was able to make that choice for my son. And I just think that beginning before they're developmentally able, it can cause frustration on the part of the educator and on the part of the child, as well as cause insecurities, possibly. As a former 5-year-old first grader who turned 6 shortly after the school year began, I can reassure you I wasn't ready. Sorry. And that little message that I got when I got pulled out of school, out of the classroom for my remedial reading and math, it stuck a message in my head that I didn't get things like other kids. And as an adult, I realize now that I actually did. I'm a home educator, and teaching my son, I came to the realization, actually it was past age 40. But the message that I had stayed with me all through my school career, and it did affect choices that I made in class selections. And I just would not want to see that happen to another child. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? And I think that one thing, you're homeschooling?
Mm-hmm.
So this would affect only the fact that you would have to sign them up a year earlier, correct?
Right.
So you'd still have an option as a parent. It's just that you would right now you have to start when they're 7. You would have to start that when they were 6, if the amendments.
And okay. I started mine at 7.
Yeah, okay, exactly. That's right. That's what I would have thought. Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next we have somebody has really beautiful handwriting, but I can't quite read it. From Benton County.
It's not mine.
Okay, it's not yours.
Celia Funk.
Thank you. It's and then Steve Buckstein and Rebecca Roth. Oh, that's Celia. I think there's another person maybe as well. So, but we'll go with you, Cecilia. Thank you.
Can I begin?
You can start.
All right. My name is Celia Funk. I'm from Benton County. And I want to say thank you, Chair Roblin, and members of the committee for this opportunity to testify. I'm strongly in opposition to this bill, Senate Bill 321. And at last Thursday's initial public hearing, one of the educators who testified in support of it stated that age is one of the single best indicators for school readiness. I have 9 years of experience working with children aged 1 to 13, and I have never reached that conclusion that age indicates developmental level. I recently was talking to a 7-year-old girl who explained concepts she'd been learning in school, chromosomes, Down syndrome, things like that. She was very articulate and knowledgeable, and I was very impressed. But I also recently supervised a 7-year-old boy who stutters badly and who struggles for a long time over a few simple math problems. And so clearly these 2 children who are the same age have very different cognitive abilities. And it's difficult and painful for me to imagine that the education system wants to put them in the same category, developmentally and educationally. I believe that forcing 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds to attend kindergarten will amplify differences like these and result in frustration and low self-esteem and teasing among their peers for these slower children. Mandatory kindergarten for 6-year-olds will promote, I think, neither equity nor diversity. it will push all children into a single mold. They're not going to fit, and I think someone's going to get hurt, and that's going to be both society and individual children. I think we're all aware that students don't enjoy their schoolwork, and forcing five-year-olds to study concepts they may not be able to understand, I think, will do nothing to improve their lifelong attitudes toward education. And as a society, I'm sure you agree, we can't afford to foster this antipathy to learning. Please support Oregonian children and vote against Senate Bill 321. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Question? Well, let's go to the panel and then come back. So,
okay. Rebecca Roth, Salem, Oregon. I recently attended, I want to talk about a little bit of the bigger picture of where I think that, where I believe that this is heading. I recently attended a presentation by Healthy Children and Families in which they presented a two-generation intervention, which they proposed was necessary because of the poor and how badly the poor raise their children. They wanted to intervene at birth to come into the homes and establish a program in which kids would be dealt with by the government in a, I guess, a daycare program you could call it, or maybe you could call it schooling from birth. I get the idea that the direction that this is going is that the state has control of you from birth until death, and they held up a program in Boston as an example. There was a Democrat representative who said at the presentation that people don't like us coming into their homes, and so we need to make them trust us. But I want to give you something that did happen in Boston that should really scare everybody, because Jessica Pelletier was a girl stolen by the state of Massachusetts in the Boston hospital, and they simply took her away from her parents and exercised the right of the state to make her a ward of the state. And once she was, this hospital conducted research on her. It was discovered by Liberty Counsel in trying to get her back from her parents. Oh, the judge had gag ordered the parents from talking.
Wrap up pretty soon.
Okay, but the dad did go on national radio and presented his case, and Liberty Counsel took up the case and did eventually free her from her captivity. She had not been offered any medical care during that entire year and a half she was held hostage. She was not offered any education, and when she was finally released, she was almost dead. Her dad had to carry her to the car. And she's still in a state of recovery. So the state having the power to say when our kids should go to school and how early they should go, I think is tied up into a desire for the state to control children. And I'm going to present this picture to you, because right now in Oregon, it's legal to kill children through all 9 months, and the state not only approves of that, but they pay for it.
Now it's time to wrap up. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a Portland-based think tank. I've submitted written testimony on OLIS, so I'll just briefly mention a couple of points. I know the time is short here. While you can compel students to attend school, whether it's age 7, 6, 5, whatever, you cannot compel them to learn whatever you want them to learn. Schooling is not the same thing as education. On February 10th, you were given a provocative and entertaining presentation by Dr. Yung Zhao, Director of Global and Online Education at University of Oregon. I personally found it fascinating, and I think some of you did too. And like a growing number of Oregon parents and teachers, one of the few things I think I maybe agree with the Oregon Education Association on, Dr. Zhao is a critic of the new high-stakes Smarter Balance tests, and he's a critic of the Common Core standards themselves. And remember that he told you in that presentation that we shouldn't make kids ready for kindergarten, we should make kindergarten ready for kids. He also said that creative kids aren't kindergarten ready because they don't conform. And can you honestly reconcile Dr. Zhao's presentation with the one that came before him by Education Czar Nancy Golden and the one that came after him in that same hearing by Deputy Superintendent of Instruction Rob Saxton. But here we are talking about requiring five-year-olds or six-year-olds to conform to the state's top-down schooling system, schooling program. And if we're going to require every school district to offer kindergarten classes, how would it look if some of those, a lot of those seats were empty? I think there's almost one of the written testimonies that's on OLA said, you know, we can't waste the investment. You're going to be requiring every district to provide kindergarten starting full day kindergarten next year. So you don't want empty seats. But compelling kids is not the way to go. I think we need to replace our top-down system, the flawed Oregon education investment model, and I know there's a work group to look at that. But I think it's all tied in together. Until you get age 7 to 18 right, don't force six-year-olds or five-year-olds into the same top-down system. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this group? Senator Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to the First Lady who spoke that has the beautiful handwriting.
No, yeah, she actually, on the other page, was better, but it's very close.
Well, thank you for the testimony. I would just ask you cited an example of two kids. One was brighter and one was a stutterer. And I was just wondering if that one example where the child was had problems, and the child who didn't went to school a year or two earlier, then when this other child did go to school, don't you think the problem would be more pronounced? Because now this brighter student has had a year or two socializing and learning, whereas this other student with stuttering problems that schools have the ability to work with, don't you think the problem would be worse?
I doubt it. I don't have the research at my fingertips to answer that, but I think that early socialization probably takes place in the home more than the school, and I think when children are put into the semi-artificial environment of a school, that's probably not beneficial overall socialization.
Oh, please.
Oh, yes, not yes.
We will agree and disagree on that, I suppose. I do take issue with your statement that students don't enjoy schoolwork. I was recently at a science fair of kindergartners, first graders, and second graders, where they showed off their experiments proudly, and everybody was having a good time. And the experiments they did in that science course show that they all had a good time.
I certainly agree with you. In the interest of time, I didn't go into that. Obviously, there are many students who enjoy their studies, like the girl that I referenced, but overall, I think that we see children who go, I don't want to go to school, and I see it in the students with whom I attend college. A lot of them are there, as I observe, to get through, to get their degree, get their grades, not interested in learning for its own sake. And that really concerns me, because I think that view comes from K through 12. I mean, it's what they've grown up with. They don't value education.
Could I respond to that real briefly? Chair Roblin, Senator Haas, I enjoyed science fairs in school, but I think the kids that are in the science fair generally are there because they want to. I think if you wrote a bill that compelled every student to be in the science fair, I think you'd find a number of them who didn't like the experience.
Any other questions? Thank you all. We have on the list Susan Farmer, and I think that's it, unless there's somebody I missed. Come on up, Susan. You get the whole dais to yourself, unless there's anybody else that wants to come up with you.
My testimony is, you have a copy of it, and I believe it's also been uploaded already to OLIS. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Susan Farmer. I'm a licensed teacher, and my credentials are listed for you. I understand truancy is a major force behind this bill, and I oppose it. One principal's online testimony shared a chronic absentee rate of 11% of kindergartners and 9% of first graders. One principal had a 26.5 chronic absentee rate in his first graders. 5 and 6-year-olds are compulsory already if enrolled. So principals say they can't get the current compulsory children to attend. Will this magically change by forcing more children to enroll? I believe kindergarten and first grade absenteeism would actually increase. Research was cited saying school retention gives threats to social emotional development. This study was retention, repeating a grade. It's irrelevant to postponing school entry. Reference was also made to a 2003 article by Dr. Marshall. His analysis of multiple studies in research concludes a child's age or maturity made no difference in developmentally appropriate kindergartners. Most of that research was conducted more than 15 years ago, before rigorous kindergarten programs started. A Tigard principal testified, quote, "Kindergarten has changed. Kindergarten is academics that includes 90 minutes of reading instruction with an expectation that all will be reading at year's end. If five-year-olds come to kindergarten not ready for these mandatory rigorous academics, how is this developmentally appropriate for these children? Even to six-year-olds, it skyrockets. First grade is now what second grade used to be. Should these children be stressed at this age that they cannot read? If schools are concerned about children starting school late and failing, screen them all. Put them in developmentally classrooms. One school district that I knew of screened all first graders and developed pre-first grade, and those children went to first grade 2 years. I would possibly support a compromise of six-year-old compulsory education if the parent could choose if that six-year-old could enter kindergarten or first grade. Senator Haas again referred to the Perry preschool program. If you look at the links that were provided, I also provided those. It explains that that is a 1960s Perry's project that followed preschoolers into adulthood. Preschool reduced remedial education and crime, so ultimately saved money. Perry also had one teacher per every six children, and teachers spent 90 minutes in each home weekly showing mothers how to teach this curriculum to their children at home. Younger siblings joined their older siblings in the same classroom. So the budget was also equivalent to $11,000 to $17,000 per child. Perry has little to do with mandatory kindergarten at Oregon's per-child budget in overcrowded classrooms. I sincerely appreciate your time and attention to this matter, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So there was no one else that came up, so we're going to close our public hearing on... Oh, come on up. Did you talk on this bill before?
Yeah, I didn't sign for testimony, but I would like to testify.
Did you testify the day before? Come on up. Come on up.
He did not.
You haven't testified before, so come on up. Thanks for catching that. You got me before I closed the hearing. That was good.
Dr. Abacha, I have a hearing impaired, so I don't listen. Can hear very well, so let's try. My name is Manuel Martinez. I reside in Kaiser, State of Oregon. I'm an American citizen, close to 50 years now. I oppose to this bill 321. The bill is totally, completely necessary. Don't help anybody but government. Now, we live in a free society. That's what this bill is for. Free society in which the education of the child is to the parents. The authority and the responsibility and duty of the parents is to guide the children. I don't see any reason why the state government has to infringe those rights. in a free society like we have now, so far, is the right of the people to decide how they want to be educated. We have pre-kindergartens all over the United States, this state. So to create kindergartens is already done. Now, what is the reason for this bill? This bill don't have nothing to do with education. This bill is for gradually controlling people. I have here, and I, of course, I can give you this for part of the record, the 1847 Principle of Communism by Frederick Engels, which is considered to be the father of communism. After Frederick Engels came Karl Marx and established Marxism. Now, it's very interesting here that, of course, he is many, many things here.
I'm going to ask you to kind of sum up, too, because we have a lot of time. But
okay,
thank you.
This is what I'm saying here.
Right.
In this document that I have, which is available in the internet, you can have that. Mr. Engel have 12 measures, dictate 12 measures to establish communism. The number 8, education of all children. From the moment they can leave their mother's care in national establishments and national cost. What you have in that bill, sir, or Mr. Chair, is nothing new. It's been here since 1847. Now, I unfortunately experienced communism. But you probably were still, I don't know how old are you, but most of you people, when you still crawling in your crib, I was fighting them because I refused subjugation. This bill, similar to what you proposed, my wife was a teacher in Cuba. She was forced at gunpoint to teach communism. She refused. She was sick. We came here, I came here in 1963, looking for freedom. Now,
we do
today
need,
or tomorrow,
we
or
do need to wrap
whatever
up.
Whatever it is,
okay,
I will fight communism at the risk of my life. I have done before. Don't sell these people, don't sell this to them. You're selling a lie.
Thank
That's all I have to say, sir.
Okay.
I don't want to take more of your time.
Thank you.
I don't ask questions because I don't debate, explain, discuss, compromise communism. I fight them.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Anyone else that we missed? Nope. We will close our testimony on Senate Bill 321. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 79. We'll have a short explanation from our administrator, and on the way up, Sarah Higginbotham, Michael Duke, and Jim Blasinger can come on up.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 79 requires school districts to provide instruction in cardiopulmonary resuscitation and the uses of automated external defibrillators. This bill may have a fiscal impact, but a statement has not been issued at this time. It has no revenue impact, and we are considering the -1 amendments. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Chair Roblin, committee members, Sarah Higginbotham with the American Heart Association. We are here today to support Senate Bill 79 along with the -1 amendments. I wanted to thank Gretchen and the chair for the time today, and I'll try and use that time as efficiently as I can. I wanted to do three main things. I wanted to highlight why we feel this is a relevant and profoundly important bill. I wanted to highlight what the aims of the bill are and then share with you a few comments about implementation. Sudden cardiac arrest in America. Nearly half a million, about 424,000 Americans suffer sudden cardiac arrest outside of a hospital setting every year. And 88% of the times that happens, it's happening in the home. So 4 out of 5 times it's happening at home. Just to clarify real quickly, when we say sudden cardiac arrest, we're not just talking about heart attack. Heart attack can certainly cause sudden cardiac arrest, and you've got this presentation in your notes, so I'll just keep moving right along. Survival rates. The United States has a national survival rate for out-of-hospital sudden cardiac arrest of just under 11%, which is unfortunate and small. We know, thanks to the work in communities all around the country and right here in Oregon, that that can be higher, and we know a lot of the factors that contribute to that. One of those factors you're going to hear about today. Oregon right now, though there are a lot of great people doing good work to collect data around sudden cardiac arrest survival rates for a statewide rate. Right now it's just happening in pockets around the state, so I don't have a statewide rate to share with you. I will share with you that 15% is the rate for the Portland metro area, and you have a couple of folks here that might be able to share different information with you about where they're from. If you suffer sudden cardiac arrest outside of the hospital, without a doubt, the best chance of survival you have is receiving bystander CPR, CPR from someone who's nearby in the first 3 to 5 minutes. This can double or even triple your chances of survival. CPR training, which is what we're going to talk about in just a second, is actually the part that makes the difference here. And we'll talk a little bit more about that right now. So CPR, for those of you that don't know, though I think a lot of you do, is actually easier than ever to learn. In 2008, the American Heart Association issued new guidelines around CPR. And what those guidelines said was that hands-only CPR, so CPR that's just compression only without the breaths, was as effective as full CPR when it came to those first critical minutes after someone suffered sudden cardiac arrest. Hands-only CPR is CPR without the breaths, and there's two critical steps. The first one is to call 911 and call for help, and the second is to push hard and fast in the center of the chest at 100 beats per minute. It's very simple. What is important to note, I think, in the context of this bill is that you do not have to be certified to perform this type of CPR. As you just heard, it's very simple. There's two core steps, and you also do not have to be certified to teach it. I'll chat in a little bit about with you about the Senate Bill 79 and what it actually does. I'll start by saying that as a result of this easier-to-learn CPR, there's been increased focus on ensuring more citizens actually know it. And as such, we've seen 20 states around the country pass legislation or rule making sure that students, before they graduate, learn the simple skill of CPR and get hands-on training. Senate Bill 79 requires school districts to include hands-on, and I'm using two phrases, so let me just highlight that. Hands-only or compression-only CPR is what I just described. It's different than full CPR. What I'm also mentioning now is hands-on training, right? So that means we want students to actually get hands-on training to learn the psychomotor skills of this, of CPR, so that they're best equipped to perform it in an emergency. This type of training does not have to result in certification, so the bill is not requiring that students get a CPR certified, take a certified course, or get a card at the end of it. Teachers do not have to be certified to teach this type of CPR. The bill allows for volunteers to help teach and train students. The instructional program and the -1 amendments address this. We want the instructional program to be based on evidence-based, nationally recognized standards. The bill also notes AED use, and so what I want to clarify is that we're asking that students be made aware of AEDs. We're not asking that they get the hands-on training with AEDs, though that's a great component. That's not what this bill does. And then really what this bill does is it's instruction that needs to be incorporated that's hands-on training so that students are getting the psychomotor skills in their health class. I will note also that we focus this bill on health because students are already learning about CPR in their curriculum. We would be open to, a lot of states have focused on physical education classes and curriculum, and so we would be open to really either. What this bill would do, we have approximately 45,000 graduates here in Oregon, and so there's approximately, if we can start implementing this, that's approximately the number of new lifesavers we'd be benefiting from in all of our communities across the state. It's quick to teach. I don't know if I've mentioned that yet. Obviously, it was quick for me to explain, and it's quick to teach. More often than not, this happens in one class period. We like to say if you needed to, you could teach it in 30 minutes or less. That's definitely doable. More often than not, teachers take a full period and make a unit out of it. I wanted to just highlight before I get into some comments about existing programs in Oregon and implementation, disparities when it comes to sudden cardiac arrest and when it comes to CPR. We know that Latino communities, African-American communities are higher risk when it comes to sudden cardiac arrest out of the hospital. And we also know that in low-income communities and some of these other communities, you are less likely to receive bystander CPR. CPR in schools, a policy like this, can help equalize and make sure that every community has lifesavers on their streets and in their homes. I'm going to run through a few quick slides, I'll be quick, that highlight some of what's happening in Oregon already when it comes to CPR in schools. And I just wanted to start by quickly highlighting one partnership from the last year that was the American Heart Association and Ross Stores. This happened all around the country. Ross raised millions of dollars and took those dollars, and AHA partnered with them to make sure those dollars went into schools in low-income communities around Ross Stores. And so that's a list right there of about 23 schools that all received CPR training kits for the entire school, along with other resources and volunteer help and support for the last year. A quick note about, and you'll hear more today from Oregon's EMS community and their broad support for this bill. This bill is supported by the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Legacy Health Systems, OHSU, and the Oregon Chapter of American College. Oregon Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. This is a list of individual fire departments who've signed on in support, though I can tell you we've talked to all of them, and everyone is supportive of the idea and the principle and recognizes how it might benefit their work. I'm going to run through about four different communities that are all doing really phenomenal and inspiring work by partnering with schools to make this happen. The first is are the cities of Beaverton, Wilsonville, Westland, Sherwood, Tualatin, and Tigard, who have partnered with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, as well as Legacy Health Systems in certain areas, to reach all of the middle schools in those cities, teaching students hands-only CPR. In some cases, those students then go out and teach others. So far, since the program started in 2011, they've trained 15,000 students. And again, sometimes students will actually take that. Their assignment will be to then go out and teach friends and family members. So they're actually reaching a larger number of the community. The second is Milwaukee, Clackamas, Happy Valley, Damascus, and Oregon City, where Clackamas Fire District has been hard at work training students. They've got the program started in 2013 and are currently working in 8 middle schools, both in health and PE classes. Southern Oregon is really another effort to be applauded. The community came together thanks to Jackson County EMS and Medford Fire, along with the other partners you see there, to create a community CPR committee. And to locate grant funding to help support the program. Thanks to them, they're well on their way to training every middle schooler in Jackson County. And thus far, I think my last numbers were about 1,200 students for our last school year. And then they do the program where each student goes out and teaches to other friends or family members. And then finally, Eugene and Springfield. Eugene Springfield Fire and Rescue developed a cardiac arrest work to improve cardiac survival rates. They started in 2012. They've taught in 10 schools, both in Springfield and Eugene, at middle and high schools, and thus far have trained approximately 3,000 students and reached about 1,500 community members through that effort. Resources and cost. I ran through the first four community programs to give you all an idea of the collaboration that can happen between local EMS, local hospitals, and other community members to make to help support the schools in their efforts to teach their students CPR. Costs can vary so a lot of school districts and schools have been able to partner and get this done at no cost with volunteers and with community partners. AHA estimates nationally that depending on the type of training utilized and the type of equipment and how much equipment school districts or schools want to invest in, that it's about $1 per student if they're not able to partner or there isn't that community support. And then wrapping up there, I included in the packet that you have just additional resources from the Red Cross to the American Heart Association to the Nick of Time Foundation. I will stop there, and thank you for allowing me to share that information with you. I'm happy to answer questions, and we have a few other people lined up today who I hope will be able to give you a good idea of what this looks like in action in communities.
Thank you very much. We'll move right down the list.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and I'm also a paramedic. I'm the president of the Western Fire Chiefs Association, and I'm a member of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. Today I'm here on behalf of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association to express our support of Senate Bill 79 with amendments. Just a little background, TVFNR serves 9 cities and 3 counties in the Portland metro area, population of over 450,000. Our cardiac arrest survival rates exceed the national average, and I attribute this not only to our department's investment in paramedics, cardiac equipment, and advanced life support drugs on every unit, but our community's demonstrated willingness to perform hands-only CPR during cardiac events. The fact is, the schools in our areas are also making a big difference. It was already mentioned, since November of 2011, 15,000 students in our district have been trained in hands-only CPR, and those are wonderful partnerships for us. All the school districts in our service area are involved. In one late-breaking piece of news, since January 1st, Beaverton School District is partnering with TVFNR to train over 4,000 students before May. So it's fantastic news. Another school in the Beaverton area that has been a great partner was Valley Catholic, a private school. Since our involvement with them, they were actually the first school in Oregon to partner with a fire department on a hands-only CPR program. There, every eighth grader is trained in hands-only CPR. They use a American Heart Association Friends and Family kit, and then they take that home and they train their friends and their family in this life-saving skill. They also teach at sporting events, community events, and family gatherings. And just last month, Valley Catholic students helped us train over 700 people in 3 hours at Washington Square Mall in Beaverton in the Tigard area. We know it's working because students have called back. Graduates of Valley Catholic have called back to the school and told stories about the lives they've saved in their community, friends, family, or just that we're at a public place and a cardiac arrest happened. They jumped in, used the skill, and saved a life. The fact is, your mission here will save lives. Requiring all Oregon students to be trained in hands-only CPR before graduating will bring more than 50,000 lifesavers to our community every single year. We appreciate the work that you are doing in our communities. You are helping change attitudes about taking action when someone needs help, and you're empowering people with knowledge to do the right thing. Oregon's Fire Service is standing ready to assist you and our schools with this simple yet life-saving program. I want to thank you for the time, and I am happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you. We'll move down the list and then we'll have questions.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Jim Balsiger, and I'm a cardiac arrest survivor. And on February 7th last year, I was shoveling snow on the back patio and collapsed due to a full cardiac arrest. Fortunately, my wife and daughter found me right away and pulled me into the house. My daughter, who recently had been got her CPR certification, immediately started hands-on only CPR. She did that for about 6 minutes until the medics arrived. The medics shocked me and were able to regain my rhythm to my heart. I was transported to the hospital and upon arrival went into full cardiac arrest again. 31 minutes later, without a pulse or a breath of air, Dr. Tuvey then asked his staff, "Does anybody object to calling off this resuscitation?" My daughter was there and she said, "Can the family object?" The doctor decided to shock me for the 22nd time. And Nurse Shelley said, "We have a pulse." They lost me a couple more times, but they got me back very quickly. I was then put into a self-induced coma to lower my body temperature. Was supposed to be for 48 hours, and told my family that I had a 10% chance of living and a 90% chance that I would be brain dead and have severe organ damage. After 10 hours, I came out of the coma, and a day and a half later, woke up to 5 crushed ribs. I never thought that I would be thanking a group of people for breaking my ribs, but I was, and I know in my heart that my daughter was responsible for at least one of them. There are many things that are unanswered for me that day, but I can tell you for certain that the reason I'm here with all of my faculties is the 45 minutes of hands-on only CPR. That CPR allowed just enough circulation to my brain, kidneys, and liver that when my heart finally kicked in, my organs could recover. Survival rate of heart attack victims is slow but surely on the rise, and thanks to efforts in training and awareness of this simple practice, as it stands, 10.4% outside of the hospital when they have an attack are only survivors. Wouldn't it be amazing to increase that percentage to 15, 20, or even 25? By teaching our children and teenagers a simple hands-on only CPR procedure, I am so grateful and proud for the reaction of my little sweets that day. So please, on behalf of myself and as a survivor, my family, and sponsors of this bill, number 7579, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that testimony. Any questions?
Just a comment, probably a disappointment. The last several sessions, we've done several bills dealing with this subject, and Senator Hass and I have always sponsored them, and we're not sponsoring this one. I'm not sure how we missed that opportunity.
Senator Hass.
Thank you. And we did work on a lot of AEDA legislation, and I would go to these conferences, and by far the most compelling comments were like yours is, well, you know, I was gone. 6 months ago, I was a dead man, but I'm back because somebody knew CPR or somebody had an AED. And, you know, it makes for a pretty compelling reason to keep pushing this forward.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Chief.
And the advances in the knowledge with regard to what you need to do have really made this a game changer. The idea that hands only works just as well as the other makes it so much easier that people will do it. You know, opening airways, doing all the other kinds of stuff caused a lot of people to not choose to get engaged because they just know all that kind of stuff. But hands only, there's really no reason. And I like the fact that you can train without being a trainer. You can, it's just really impressive. So thank you.
Thank you.
So next we'll have Ali Massey, Kaylee Nelson, and looks like Katie King.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I always tried to get Katie King to testify several times during the session.
Okay, that's good.
Robles and committee. My name is Allie Massey, and I'm a physical education teacher at Fowler Middle School in Tigard. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 79. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I wanted to share with you my experience providing hands-on CPR training to my students at Fowler. For the last 2 years, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue has offered to train students at Fowler Middle School in hands-only CPR. Last year, they worked with a health teacher at Fowler, and this year, I was eager to provide the training to my PE students. We were able to complete each training in one class period. Firefighters from TVFNR led the training and provided the equipment. While the students really enjoyed the visitors from the fire department, hands-only CPR training is simple and is something I could teach my students myself. Over the course of 2 days, we trained 197 students, half of the seventh graders and half of the eighth graders in our school. These students went home with the assignment to teach five of their friends and family and train 927 community members, making a total of 1,123 trained community members in the Tigard community. This is something my students and I are very proud of. As a middle school physical education teacher, it is a challenge to engage every student in any activity. There is always someone who doesn't like the unit or activity we're working on, but it was very different with the CPR training. Every student was eager to participate and found it compelling. Many middle school students struggle with work completion, but they were mostly eager to complete this one. 90% of my students completed this assignment on time. That's huge. When I asked kids what they liked about this, over and over again, I heard, "I could save a life." In my opinion, middle school isn't always just about academics. It's also about learning about yourself, your strengths, your weaknesses, your interests and values, what is important to you. One of the most important things that students can learn in is how to be helpful, concerned, and active members of their community. Knowing how to perform the simple act of CPR to save a life is a perfect fit for a curriculum in middle school health or PE class. CPR training is something that every Oregon student can and should learn in school. I ask for your support of Senate Bill 79. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Roblin and the rest of the committee. Thank you for having us here and hearing us out. My name is Kaylee Nelson. I am currently resident of Springfield, Oregon. This last June, I graduated from the University of Oregon, and I'm currently a volunteer with the ACSI 3 initiative in Springfield and Eugene to train middle schoolers there. So it has been active since 2012. We've trained over 3,000 students in CPR, and the first thing I want to say is when we go into a school, these students are excited and engaged, and this is empowering students to go out there. So to share the importance of this, I want to share my own story. In 2011, I watched as my sister had a seizure. And this is not a common thing. She's not epileptic. It was terrifying for me. We were in a mall. There was a crowd of 20 people around us, and no one knew how to step forward and help. Now, thankfully, she did not need CPR that day, but if she did, I'm concerned that no one would have known what to do. So I became active, and I wanted to never feel that scared and that helpless ever again. I wanted to be empowered. I wanted to know how to perform CPR in an emergency situation. And that's why I've been going into schools and teaching these children to do the same thing. To me, Senate Bill 79 is common sense. Why shouldn't we be teaching students how to save people? They're looking up to doctors and firefighters and thinking, oh, they're the savers. But it takes between 6 and 8 minutes for an ambulance to come to a home. And the first 4 minutes is the most important for your brain activity in cardiac arrest. So immediate CPR from a bystander is one of the most important things for someone who goes into cardiac arrest. So thank you again for hearing us out. And like we said earlier, this would put over 45,000 trained lifesavers to our Oregon community every year. So just imagine all the lives that they could be saving. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And OSEP supports Senate Bill 79. Out-of-hospital cardiac arrest claims the lives of 3,000 Oregonians each year. Studies show that bystander CPR is one of the critical determinants in surviving out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And cities that have the highest such survival rates also have mandatory hands-on training as part of the K-12 curriculum. It doesn't take much. As little as 20 minutes of hands-on CPR training in total can help increase community CPR rates. Bystander CPR is a critical component in the chain of survival for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and this bill could vastly increase the percentage of trained bystanders in our community. And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Any questions for anybody here? Thank you very much. With that, we have one person left. If there's anybody else, they can come up. Rebecca Roth, and this needs to be tight to the bill, so you need to talk about 79.
Hello.
Hello.
Salem, Oregon. Rebecca Roth. And I've had some thoughts while I'm listening to this, and one of them is that when we train children, I actually have no position on the bill. I'm just trying to think of some things that are problems, and one is that we'll have kids who are receiving training from other kids on how to do this, and these are children who are making life and death decisions as though they were medical people, and if they've received their training from another child, what if the training wasn't complete? What if it wasn't adequate to help them save a life? And what if somebody sues afterwards because the child didn't do the right things that supposedly they were supposed to be trained to do, and somebody who receives that dies and the family sues? So I think that in America we're suit happy, and too many lawyers chase ambulances. And I remember back when we were having this medical care system being taken over by the state, which is a concern to me. We were talking about how lawyers are affecting the system, and we were saying to the representatives, please don't allow the lawyers to have so much power over doctors. That's what's part of what's driving up costs. Well, here we are talking about children intervening in a medical way and not having reined in the lawyers. And may I remind you that it's legal in Oregon to inject something into the heart of a child and make the child's heart stop. And nobody steps in because the state approves of stopping that child's heart, of killing that child, and we have to pay for it. The state pays for the children to be killed in Oregon, and nobody steps in.
We're going to go back.
We need to train children to save children's lives, even preborn children.
So just so you know, children and other bystanders who intercede in this deal do have immunity from that particular thing if they had been trained. And I do
by other children?
Even if they've been trained by other children.
Well, that's crazy.
So, just so you know. Okay, is there anybody else who would like to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 79, and I thank everybody for the testimony and for being here to help us with this discussion. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 875, and with that, we'll have a short explanation, and we'll have Jennifer Knapp and Christine Norgaard come on up.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Senate Bill 875 requires the State Board of Education to adopt rules under which school personnel may administer medications that treat adrenal insufficiency to students experiencing an adrenal crisis. This bill may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not been issued at this time. This bill does not have a revenue impact, and we're not considering amendments at this time.
Proceed.
Thank you, Senator Roblin and members of the Education Committee. My name is Jennifer Knapp. I am a teacher, the executive director of Adrenal Insufficiency United, and most important, mother to a child with adrenal insufficiency. I am speaking in support of Senate Bill 875. Adrenal insufficiency is a life-threatening condition. The human body produces four different hormones vital to life. 75% of children with adrenal insufficiency are missing two of these hormones. 100% are missing one. Cortisol, the hormone that regulates the heart, blood pressure, and other body systems. In times of crisis, you and I make 10 times the amount of cortisol, so to help our body deal with that added stress. A child with adrenal insufficiency cannot make that, and without an immediate injection, they can be dead within 30 minutes. As a teacher, I'm trained to help children missing another of the four hormones, insulin. I've been trained to give a glucagon injection to children with diabetes who are in crisis. I've also been trained to give an EpiPen to students with severe allergies. Senate Bill 875 will require training for teachers who have a student in their classroom with adrenal insufficiency. Dr. Mitch Geffner, president of the Pediatric Endocrine Society, has submitted written testimony in support of this bill. Parents will provide this injection, and Adrenal Insufficiency United is developing a training. The National College of Technical Instruction is actually developing this training, and it will be geared towards health providers, and it will be free of charge to anyone who would like to take it. They will also be able to get continuing education credits if they're a nurse, and they can use that to help train the teachers. Our group is also willing to dedicate both funds and time to create training packets, such as this one here for glucagon training, so that when school nurses are training teachers, they can give the teacher a packet. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Hello. My name is Kirsten. Oops, I'm sorry.
Could you pull, and you can pull one of the microphones over,
sorry.
Too. That's fine.
I'm just a
tiny just relax, bit take a deep breath, and enjoy.
Okay. It was a long drive. Thank you, Senator Roblin, and the senators of the Education Committee. My name is Kirsten Norgaard, and I am president and co-founder of Adrenal Insufficiency United, and I'm also the mother to Tristan Norgaard, bright-eyed, red-headed 6-year-old boy who is now in kindergarten. A time in his life that I was dreading since his diagnosis at 7 days old. Because I know how to take care of him. His dad knows how to take care of him. Some doctors know, but I was worried about what would happen when he was in school. I researched a lot, and we decided a 504 plan was the best. We got the 504, and everything went great. The school nurse showed the staff how to give his injection, what to look for. We gave all the information they could possibly need. And his school nurse actually called me yesterday and said that she had taken a continuing education course, and in that, this legislation was brought up in that course, and all school nurses were reminded that it is illegal to train anyone else to give this life-saving injection to my son, and that our 504 needs to be completely redone. And I'm not okay with that. If that happens, I'm gonna have to retain a lawyer and sue the school district for a full-time nurse. As it stands right now in Clatsop County, my son is in the Astoria School District, and we have one school nurse for 3 schools, and she is only at each school 1.5 days out of the week. So those other 3.5 days, I don't know who's gonna give him a shot if he needs it. And this bill will change that. This bill will make it so that the teachers and the lunch lady and any school staff that, you know, they know my son. My son is a light in the school system. His teacher wrote an excellent letter just talking about how she wouldn't hesitate to give him the shot that she's been trained to do. But now she's not even allowed to do that. So if that could change, it would change so many lives, including my son's.
Any questions? Yes.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer, could you comment on the risk and the timing if you had an event, and contrast that, I guess, with we spent a lot of time on this committee in the last session dealing with the EpiPen issue, mm-hmm. and contrast the complexity of this injection versus the EpiPen.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Roblin and Senator Beyer, for your question. For adrenal insufficiency, I have notebooks that I gave to most of you or one of your office staff, and there's a pathway on the back that's a really great illustration. So adrenal insufficiency, from the time the crisis begins, death can occur in as little as 30 minutes or less. Depending on the mechanism of injury, what the health of that child was in the first place, you know, how the injury happened. So, and it can be from an emotional stress, a physiological stress. So there's different ways that it can happen. The reason that this is so important is that the EMTs are not allowed to inject either. So if Tristan were to be at school and fell and broke his arm and they couldn't inject Tristan, they would then have to call the EMTs, who would have to come. And thanks to Kirsten, the EMTs in Astoria can give him the injection, but in other counties they can't. So the EMTs come, they can't give the injection. They go to the ER. The ER doesn't have protocols either. So we've lost our 30-minute window. So that's why it's vital that teachers be able to inject this. With the glucagon and EpiPen, we're instructed to give it immediately as soon as we see those symptoms coming. And we're told, you know, give the injection because it's better to give it if they don't need it than not to give it. Dr. Geffner has said that in his letter, that if a teacher gives the hydrocortisone injection to a child that doesn't need it and the child has adrenal insufficiency, it will not hurt that child. If they measure too much hydrocortisone and give them too much, it won't hurt that child. If they don't give it, that child could suffer irreversible brain damage or die. So it's much better to give it than to not. I hope that answers your question.
Very well.
Yeah, very well. And I was thinking with diabetes and stuff, with juvenile onset or type 1 diabetes, it was always weird to me that when they start having effect, give them sugar, because giving them sugar won't hurt them, but not enough of it can put them into the coma and cause the problems too. So, I mean, I think the medical profession has figured these things out, and I appreciate the letter from the doctor.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No questions. I echo your sentiment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Just a yes, ma'am. Is that pretty much it?
So, Tricia Smith and Rebecca Roth. And Trish, you want to go first?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And in spite of the heart-wrenching testimony you've just heard, I must come and offer our opposition to Senate Bill 875 as it's written. I'd like to explain why. You may remember that we represent classified school employees in K-12, and our members are the folks in schools who most often are tasked with administering medication or medical procedures to students. We've testified, I think, before you in the past about our great concern with that responsibility, since educational assistants and secretaries in schools are not medical professionals, they don't have a medical background, and the training that they receive is often significantly insufficient in their own mind. Because they are not medical professionals, when they receive a 40-minute video or a 30-minute video on how to administer medication, they don't feel confident after that training. If they don't have a nurse in their school, they know that they will be the ones responsible if something happens to the student to administer the medication correctly in order to help the student. We don't believe that this bill provides adequate training to our members. We think it's naive to assume that a competent person will always be there to administer this medication. There are, in my understanding and research, that there are less than 40 kids on average in the state who might have this condition. So the idea that a person in school may be trained and then never see a student until who knows when, and then by that time, how has the training been retained? We believe that the sponsors who indicated that some EMTs in some areas and emergency room personnel have not been trained to administer this medication, we think it would be a better idea to train medical personnel to do medical procedures than to train educational personnel to do medical procedures. And so we would look forward to a bill that redirects this requirement to medical professionals and not classified school employees, which is where it will end up if this bill passes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tricia, I'm trying to recall, did OSCA have the same position on the EpiPens and the other things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no, we did not. Our understanding, and the reason we did not, is because an EpiPen comes preloaded. It is a medication that anyone can administer. It doesn't require great training on symptoms or outcomes. And so we don't view that as the same situation as we do with this medication, which must be, the dosage must be right, the way it's administered must be right. And this is a life or death crisis situation this child is in, and our members would prefer 911 be the solution.
If I heard the testimony correctly, 911 may not be an answer at all because of timing, and it sounded like the risk of doing it wrong was minimal. The risk of not doing it was fatal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I did hear the risk of not doing anything is fatal, and that's certainly a serious issue. But if there is a 30-minute window, in most cases, I believe there is time for medical personnel, emergency medical personnel to arrive. And if the district has a school nurse, most of them have a school nurse, that school nurse hopefully will have been, if she has a student with this deficiency, she will have already been in contact with her EMTs and her ER to assure that there is a process for that student.
Tricia, I would agree with you. It would be preferable that every school had a school nurse, but as you know, that's not the case. That's not likely to be the case anytime soon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roblin, we agree with that. There is generally one somewhere in the district, and that one would be responsible for figuring out what to do with this student. Our only concern is responsibility rolling downhill to the people who cannot thrust it off of themselves, that being the classified employee who has no medical training beyond this video and is then thrust in the position of trying to save a student's life when they may not feel confident or comfortable with that responsibility.
They probably wouldn't be very comfortable if the student died either.
I agree with that, Senator. Those hopefully aren't the only two solutions.
Other questions? I just had one. If the bill were basically to instruct when a student appears in the school district, the training take place so that the training comes with the child, because I agree, training everybody and then assuming they might not get one for 20 years is probably not a good way to get there. But if we're actually saying, you know, the 504 or whatever plan, and then make sure that the people who are there, who understand the plan, all of them have the training, so there's a group of people, teachers, administrators, and classified, as I said, right, who would be trained specifically for that particular child. Would that make it easier or not?
Mr. Chair, that might make it some easier if you would add EMTs and the emergency room personnel in that community to that list, then we would feel much better.
Okay, I appreciate that thought. Yeah, thank you for that. Because I'm trying to think, and this is just another question about that same line. There are a number of other diseases, chronic problems with people out there,
yes,
which have other solutions that are necessary in each case. And if we're going to have kids at schools that have these problems, maybe not just this particular one, but maybe we should look at a larger deal that says when they come to the schools and we have a knowledge of what it is that they're needed, that there be a plan developed that include all those people and whatever is needed for that particular person. Is that something, it would be a larger scale, but it would maybe have the idea that we're going to have these multidisciplinary groups formed whenever this child is available so that we can align that kind of stuff. Does that sound reasonable to you as well?
Mr. Chair, it does sound like an excellent line of thought that we need to travel down. How medication and medical procedures are administered in schools was decided years ago, And then students started coming into schools with medical conditions that we did not anticipate. And unfortunately, even though that has occurred, it is still the hourly, low-wage, classified school employee, the school secretary, or the educational assistant, who is tasked way too often with administering these procedures. And we have not looked at the whole gambit of medical issues that are occurring in schools. Golly, I don't know that we ever have, at least not in my recent memory. And it might be a good idea to do that. I think if legislators really understood how this happens in schools, where it cannot happen any other place, where an untrained person or a person who is not a licensed medical professional can be administering these procedures and these medications, that it can happen in schools, I think is something that you should keep a better eye on than we have in the past. And I'd be looking forward to that.
I would only say that having been a dean of students in a school that was disciplined and also worked with the school nurse, who in my particular case had cancer and therefore was not there a lot. And so I got it, the responsibility of doing a lot of this kind of stuff. It became apparent to me that I needed to get the training and figure out whatever I could do, because I was acting as the parent when that person came to the school. And we have a lot of history that basically says if we're going to do these things, we better recognize some of those responsibilities. And I agree with you that a lot of these procedures can't be done with anybody outside of the medical profession except as parents. And I will tell you that there are very few of these kids that have conditions that parents aren't instructed how to do it, because I've had my kids that had different kinds of issues, and the medical profession trained us pretty well on how to deal with our own child and their particular instances, because they didn't know where we were going to be and what time it was going to happen. So
that's right.
Parents were that first line, and there's a part of me that takes it right into the school when we're taking responsibility for some of these kids.
Mr. Chair, we have parents who are essentially on call with their schools.
Yes, we do.
Because their children are medically fragile and they have issues. And when the student has issues, the parent is called, comes, and because that parent is trained, the parent takes over and deals with those issues. It doesn't happen everywhere. It doesn't happen with every child, certainly. But that does happen, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
and because these are other people's children, I think an overabundance of caution is what we should be doing, not throwing up our hands and saying, well, we don't have school nurses, so I guess you secretaries have to do it.
Our dean of students.
Our principals.
Our principals. Yeah, that's right.
Who mostly tell the secretary to do it.
Well, maybe some. I'm just saying there's a number of us who feel really responsible,
right,
and I would rather not put that responsibility to anybody else. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And anybody else have a question for her?
No, Mr. Chair, I think it's a good idea that we need to kind of step back a little bit and take a 30,000-foot view of this and see if we're approaching it the right way.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Roth.
Chair Roblin, my name is Rebecca Roth, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. And this lady has said everything so eloquently and way more than I wanted to say. So I'm very privileged to have heard her testimony. So now that the state is in charge of our health care, I'm concerned about the direction that this is going, where the state is choosing to put forward a bill that would give, again, medical training to people who aren't trained in any other way medically and may not see a person like that for a long time, where the training gets really dull. And in socialist countries, often the people who are put forward as being medically trained are not adequately medically trained. And so often the state doesn't pay attention to the training in socialist countries where there's supposedly state-sponsored health care. So the fact that we have to come here and talk about this, that we're talking about a secretary giving a shot when it's obviously medically not a a good thing to let people give medications when they're not adequately trained. It shows that the state needs to back out of the healthcare system and let the healthcare system be the free healthcare system that we've grown to admire.
And the only thing I would say to your comments is that this bill came about because some parents asked for the government to help. It wasn't one that we came up with necessarily by ourselves, but it was a need that was seen by parents of kids that had some issues. And so we take that very seriously as our responsibility to act on their behalf as well. So.
Chair Roblin, that man who was talking here at the other, the man from the communist country,
right.
He would tell you, there's a place on the internet that's called Voices of Communism, and you can go and hear the people talk who've been under communist systems. And the supposedly good state-sponsored health care is often highly inadequate because the state should not be in the health care business.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? If you want to come on back, I'd love to have you come on back.
Thank you. All right, well, thanks again, Senator Roblin and members of the Health Committee. I just wanted to address a couple of the things. One is the incidence of adrenal insufficiency. While it is more rare than diabetes, statistically there are 1,500 students between the ages of kindergarten to 12th grade that have primary adrenal insufficiency, and there are also studies that show that there are 6 million in the United States that are undiagnosed with secondary adrenal insufficiency, which statistically puts that number at 14,000 students in Oregon. And I understand the classified and certified issue. At our school, it is the certified employees that are trained to give the injections, plus the school health aide, who works very closely with the nurse. And I realize that may not be the same in every school district. So, you know, possibly one thing would be to say that it needs to be a certified staff person, and that would take that off of the classifieds table, because I've worked as both a classified employee and a certified employee, and certified employees, we do have more time for trainings and to meet with our school nurses. So that might be an idea. That's all I wanted to say about that. Thank you.
Okay. Did you want us to add anything? Or?
I did at the time, and I don't remember what I was
okay.
say.
No problem. No problem. It does that to people sometimes.
We'd be happy to answer any questions.
I appreciate
it. It's hard
that.
To get everything in a very small window.
We appreciate it. Pardon? We may look at an amendment. That's something that we could do. But we'll get back to you, and we'll look at this. We'll talk to some other people. We'll talk to people who helped sponsor the bill. So thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Since we brought up the idea of certified only, is there anybody else that wants to speak to the bill or not? I was just looking out and seeing if there are people here who represent some of those people.
Oh, okay.
So I was looking around to see how they were reacting, and that's why.
I did think of one other incidence would be field trips, after-school sports, all those kinds of things. When there's not a school nurse that necessarily goes on a field trip, we have had children in our group denied the opportunity to play sports or participate in field trips because no one is able to inject.
I was sick with pneumonia when my son got to go on his first field trip, and my husband was out of town for work. And his teacher, you know, she had been trained on giving the shot. I asked her if she wanted a recourse, you know, just to make sure that she got it. She said, nope, I feel like I'm fine. She took the shot kit with her. He actually was due for medication during the trip, too, that she gave it to him, and there were no issues. And she felt totally safe doing it. Because I was going to see if my sister could go in my place since I couldn't. She said, actually, I'm totally fine with taking care of him.
Okay.
Thank you again.
And I appreciate creative thinking by parents and others to help make their kids have abilities to work with schools and with professional people to try to solve some of these problems. And I appreciate that in you. And I know that you're here not for your own child as much as you are for others, because you've kind of worked things out in some ways for your own. So
right.
I do appreciate that a lot. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So we will, anybody else who didn't get to speak that would like to speak on this issue, and I have to say it was a new issue for me, and I thought I had most of them down. So on these different kind of health things, having kind of been my interactive school nurse for a little while. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 875. Anything else for the good of the order for anybody? Seeing none, we're going to adjourn our Senate Education Committee here on the 12th.